Thank you for tuning in to the FactCheckVaccine.com audio stream podcast. If you find the following information helpful, please share it with others. And now we begin the audio stream.
Also, Whitney Webb, are you there? Can you hear us? Oder nicht?
Hi, can you
great.
Hear me? Hi,
yes,
hello,
we
sorry.
Can see you.
Okay.
How are you doing? Whoops.
Okay. All things considered.
Under the circumstances, yes.
Yeah.
So, you probably don't speak German, right?
No, I speak Spanish. That's it for
good.
Me.
I don't.
It's all right.
We were interviewing a medical doctor who managed to publish, together with other colleagues, a new study on the benefits and risks of mask mandates. And they managed to publish it in one of the most renowned magazines, Journal of Pediatrics. It's making mm-hmm. headlines already. It was very difficult to get it published, but he did it.
I imagine.
And
yeah.
The thing that we're wondering about is how come, and he said he just filmed a short video, a clip, published it on this 9 minute or so on his news or on their new study, and was taken down by YouTube within minutes. And
right.
That's what we are thinking, that maybe you can tell us something about what's going on there. Who is trying to influence what and by what means and so on?
Well, I guess I would first of all point to YouTube's parent company, Google, which, among other things, is invested directly in the AstraZeneca vaccine through Vaccitech, and also more broadly, this push by Silicon Valley to basically remake the healthcare system entirely, and a lot of this about moving to telemedicine and basically changing the normal paradigm of medical care. They're invested in that specifically because they, along with Microsoft and some of these other companies, are looking to move healthcare, basically replace doctors with artificial intelligence apps and things like that. There's efforts underway in the UK, where I am, for example, to replace the NHS, the National Health Service, with something called NHSX, which is basically an app along these lines that they're seeking to basically, replace the existing medical system with down the line. And they had plans to do this, of course, before COVID-19. And in the U.S. as well, the former head of Google, Eric Schmidt, was in charge of the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence in the U.S. And that they had a presentation that they authored in 2019. It didn't come out until a year later or so, but basically said that the big changes they needed to see in the implementation, widespread implementation of emerging technologies, including AI, needed to happen in healthcare first. And of course, we've seen that happen, over the course of the past year or so.
So they're using healthcare as a kind of a crowbar to get full control.
Yeah, well, I think that's where they start. They've started to sort of reimagine healthcare as a way of taking control and over people's lives, telling them it's for the benefit of the public, the collective, for public mm-hmm. health, and also their personal health. Whereas it's really a way to sort of implement sort of these more transhumanist or technocratic technologies under the guise of it being a health-related venture. And Google, of course, is intimately invested in all of this, and they're actually partnered on a lot of this directly with the U.S. military. So, you know, the fact that they're censoring stuff that, you know, goes against the narrative that they want to put forth on matters relating to public health, whether it's COVID-19 or really anything else, really shouldn't surprise anyone.
Yeah, this is, what was that? Google is invested in AstraZeneca?
Yeah, so the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, they've been publicly framing for a long time as nonprofit. That's not exactly true, because the two developers of that at the Jenner Institute at Oxford, Sarah Gilbert and Adrian Hill, have a company on which the technology of that vaccine is based, called Vaxitech, and Google Ventures is one of the main investors in that company, which is set to make a lot of profits. as soon as they decide that the pandemic from their perspective has ended, which they can make that declaration, they can make as a company whenever they feel like it, really. So
Because before I forget, what is your background? I saw a couple of videos with you. One of them was an interview with Bobby Kennedy, for example. And I know you're maybe that's your real job. You're an investigative journalist, right?
Yeah. So I started off being a staff writer for Mint Press News, which is a U.S.-based media outlet. I eventually became their senior investigative reporter. I did a series on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal that got a lot of buzz. I ended up leaving in the beginning-ish of 2020. And sort of I started doing my own thing, though I did partner with a website that's also mainly a YouTube channel called The Last American Vagabond as a, you know, as a partnership when I first sort of left Mint Press.
Okay. So I didn't quite understand. How does this work? How can they end the pandemic? And what happens if they say this is the end? Vax attack, I guess. Yeah.
Well, it's how they set this up. So they just declare it as that. They can do that as a company, but they don't necessarily have to publicly say if that's the case or not. And then they can begin generating more profit than they have been off of the AstraZeneca vaccine candidate. I should mention also that in addition to Google, the UK government is also directly invested in VaxAttack and is expected to make a profit off of that vaccine, despite, you know, how it was presented to the public. And then the other main stakeholder is Bravos Capital, which, if I'm not mistaken, was set up by the former head of global equity trading at Deutsche Bank. So those are the people that
fits right in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also here, you know that this CureVac, which holds the patents on the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine, the German government had also invested a lot of money into that.
Not surprising.
No, in CureVac.
Yeah, CureVac is owned, I think 20% of the shares is owned by the German government. And they seem to be the patent holder to the vaccine. I forget the name.
That would be the Pfizer vaccine and the vaccine, BioNTech one.
BioNTech, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so is that all? I mean, we have now three shareholders or people or companies that have invested in VaxAttack. We have Bravos Capital with Deutsche Bank
Well, technically the Bravos Capital investment is through something called Oxford Science Innovation, and Bravos Capital is the main shareholder of that.
Okay.
Right, so they sort of hide it in a few ways.
And then there's the UK government and there's Google. And
Google Ventures, and Google's been really there's the Sequoia Capital Chinese branch, and Fosun Pharma, which I believe is a Chinese pharmaceutical company.
How's that spelled?
The Wellcome Trust also.
The Wellcome Trust also. Well, everyone.
Wellcome Trust is intimately involved with the AstraZeneca vaccine, period. They're the institution most involved with them to a significant degree. And they have some pretty disturbing eugenicist links that we can get into if those are of interest. But the it's through Oxford Science Innovations, one of the Wellcome Trust investment.
Okay, I got it. Das müssen wir kurz übersetzen. So is this is something that I have never heard before. I mean, Viviana has obviously heard of this before, but is this one of the major vehicles that we're discussing right now in the context of this vaccine scheme, VaxAttack?
Well, it's specifically for the technology used in the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine. And of course, they plan to use more vaccines with that. And a lot of this is the vaccines produced by the Jenner Institute are intimately linked to VaxAttack, because the people that run that institute are also the people that founded VaxAttack. And VaxAttack is actually in Africa right now. Well, sorry, the Jenner Institute and a vaccine that's tied to VaxAttack is conducting trials on really young children in Africa right now for a universal malaria vaccine. They say it started last December. And they have quite a nasty track record. The Jenner Institute, led by Adrian Hill, who developed the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, with being not quite honest with parents about the risks of the vaccine and trials. I believe it was in South Africa. About 7 infants died, and they lied about the risk. They knew in advance the vaccine was ineffective before they did the trial, but they just did it anyway. And, you know, of course, their conclusion of that trial was that it was ineffective, even though they knew that well in advance.
They knew that well in advance, and they still went forward with this.
Yeah, this was in 2009. So they have a track record of being very dishonest with their trials. They also hid results of animal trials from parents.
What's their Jenner Institute? What's their general purpose? And how long have they been around?
Well, okay. So originally they were a public-private partnership with GlaxoSmithKline in the UK government in the 1990s. And then eventually GlaxoSmithKline pulled out, and they were essentially remade. And I believe they were reopened in 2005. They're essentially one of the main vehicles at Oxford University for vaccine development, but also more broadly for UK vaccine funding research in general, because the head of the Jenner Institute, Adrian Hill, is also the chief person at the UK Vaccine Network, which decides which vaccine technology to research, what vaccines to fund, and what vaccines to give to the population, but also not just in the UK, but globally through vaccine philanthropy.
Okay.
And the Jenner Institute is sort of seemingly independent, or like you said, public-private partnership, but their purpose is to...
It's part of Oxford University. It used to be. It was originally a public-private partnership, but GlaxoSmithKline removed themselves at some point. GlaxoSmithKline, by the way, is also intimately tied to the Wellcome Trust, which, again, is very much connected to the Jenner Institute, because the company, the Wellcome Trust is named for Henry Wellcome, and part of GlaxoSmithKline before the 1990s, when they merged with Glaxo, was the company Burroughs Wellcome, which is where the Wellcome Trust essentially comes from. So
okay, let me translate this because this
I'm sorry,
is,
that's a lot of info.
That's all right. That's all right. To summarize this, this seems to be the crowd that pushes AstraZeneca, but then there's another crowd probably around the Gates Foundation. Here's the Wellcome Trust about around the Gates Foundation that's pushing the mRNA vaccines. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, but it's slightly different. So if you've noticed how this has played out over time, the AstraZeneca vaccine has largely been banned in most developed countries, yes. Or in developed countries, they've restricted its use, keeping it mainly for the elderly, which is the case in the UK, though there are some countries that have banned it outright. But however, COVAX, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the Gates-backed effort to vaccinate the developing world, relies almost entirely on AstraZeneca, despite the fact that there's been all these findings that have led governments in developed countries not to use it. But it's still considered safe for Africa, for Latin America, for Southeast Asia, India, you know. So clearly that's a considerable double standard. And when you look into the history of the Wellcome Trust and also the Gates Foundation, and essentially experimenting on the developing world in things that predate COVID-19 considerably, it doesn't paint a very nice picture. But also more broadly, the pharmaceutical industry does this. For example, with the polio vaccine, in most of the developed world now, it's an inactivated polio virus. It was previously a live virus, polio vaccine, and the live polio vaccine was not discontinued despite the evidence showing it was causing more polio cases than it prevents. It's actually still widely used in the developing world, including where I used to live in Chile.
So. Okay, I got that.
Okay, I have another question. This Moderna and Johnson & Johnson, are these sort of backup vaccines, or like, well, how do they play into this larger picture?
So I know a lot more about the AstraZeneca vaccine because I did a really long report on it that actually got me deplatformed from Patreon. They tried to take away like
from
all my
Patreon
income
even.
Over it. Yeah, yeah. So the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, how it was developed itself and its background, I don't exactly know. But Johnson & Johnson has a really bad track record as well that I think should be pretty obvious to anyone that looks into large pharmaceutical companies. I think by and large, the mRNA vaccines, they weren't for some reason used more in the developed world than the developing world, because that's how it's played out to a significant degree thus far. But, you know, they could be backup vaccines. I don't exactly know, because, frankly, we don't know the long-term effects of these vaccines. So I think, a more accurate answer to that question will probably come, within the coming months or years. But I do think it is significant that Johnson & Johnson specifically was being manufactured in the U.S. by a company called Emergent BioSolutions, which previously was called BioPort and was essentially created as a fusion of a spinoff of Port and Down of the U.K. They're like biodefense, bioweapons lab in the United Kingdom. With the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the U.S. military on a Ronald Reagan is essentially how that company came to be. They, as I did in a whole series last year, were intimately involved in what happened with the 2001 anthrax attacks, because it was basically the only way they were going to manage to save their mandatory for U.S. military personnel anthrax vaccine program. And of course, they've been involved in scandals really ever since then to a significant degree, but were chosen to manufacture it despite that. And the person they put in charge of their quality control at this facility that was manufacturing these Johnson & Johnson vaccines has no experience in that at all, or really in the field of any sort of pharmaceutical or development or chemistry or anything. His background is being head of military intelligence teams for the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan, and is also an expert on Iran and North Korea. It really doesn't make sense why he'd be in charge of that. But of course, more recently, the scandal that's developed in the U.S. with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is that these batches were ruined, they say, basically unusable. And who knows what would have happened to people if that had been widely used. But it's very interesting that this is the company that manufactured that vaccine. Of course, they gave Johnson & Johnson a pass on that, and the blame has been placed on Emergent BioSolutions. But of course, nothing has really been done to them as a company. They're intimately connected to the U.S. military and also to the CIA and military contractor in Ohio, Battelle, which has a lot of ties to the anthrax attacks as well.
I'm sorry. Wolfgang wants to ask you a question.
Yes, thank you. I'm very interested in who's controlling the contents of the jabs. Is there a control which is independent from the producer? Or the FDA, is there something very transparent controlling what is really in the jabs? Because we have a situation that it's all emergency stuff what is used now, and so many controls are bypassed now, and we are a little bit suspicious that maybe the pharmaceutical industry or the industry for vaccine industry is just using this possibility to find out what is possible with nuclein acid and with RNA vaccines and all this stuff, because normally there were very strict rules when they wanted to use such a technology, and now they can do all they want. And they can. I would be very interested in whether there's someone scanning the patents that have been issued or that have been asked for in this field. I think they must have grown rather rapidly, because there is so big chance now to use this technology in many fields where it was a taboo before. And I'm very interested whether they use this chance to make clinical studies, perhaps undercover, because we don't know it. Nobody observes it, and nobody can really control it. When you see funny pictures, people putting metal on their vaccination, right. And there is nothing in the contents, which is declared by the companies, you don't see anything which is declared that could explain this phenomenon. Perhaps it's a fake, but I don't know.
Magnetofaction.
I think we should have some means to control what is really in the jabs. And so we found out that there are some jabs where physiological sodium chloride, where salt water was in it. And so it may be the control they use, you know, when they want to try out something, they have the same, they take some control and they find out the difference. So they can just do everything now. They can make us the laboratory rats.
The guinea pigs.
The guinea pigs, yes. Mm-hmm. And
It sounds like there's two questions there. So the first is, the first thing I want to say is that there definitely needs to be more attention given to the manufacturers of the vaccine, because the developers, right, ostensibly just develop the formula, which is then given to the manufacturers who actually produce and create the vaccine that is injected into people. So in the case of the U.S., the main manufacturer, not just for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but I believe a few others, is that same company, Emergent BioSolutions. Which has an awful track record of, the Pentagon lost a lawsuit in 2004 where they were accused of using U.S. military personnel as lab rats in an experimental off-label use of that particular anthrax vaccine they were producing. So, you know, they have a really nasty track record with that stuff, but are still being given contracts.
Who lost that lawsuit?
It was the Pentagon. But the Pentagon in the U.S. military is intimately connected, as I mentioned earlier, to this company, Bioport, now Emergent BioSolutions. Okay. And they have a lot of interlocking ties with the U.S. military and also with the Department of Health and Human Services as well. Mm-hmm. In terms of the mRNA technology, I definitely agree that they seized on this opportunity to use it more widely. So the hidden hand, I would argue, again, with the mRNA vaccine is once again the U.S. military. If you look at both the Pfizer and Moderna's mRNA technology, those both really started with a significant investment in 2013 to both companies from DARPA. Which is the advanced research branch of the U.S. military, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. And they're of course, intimately involved in a lot of other very Orwellian, also, you could argue, transhumanist technologies for the use in soldiers, and also the general public, for example, have heavily invested in research regarding brain-machine interfaces, among other things. And a lot of people there are very extreme. They recently teamed up in a significant way with the Wellcome Trust to create something called Wellcome Leap that I wrote about recently, that's quite unsettling. But if you look, for example, back a couple years in 2016, where they're talking about Moderna in mainstream media, well, more health-focused mainstream media outlets in the U.S., they talk about how Moderna had run into major problems with their vaccine technology platform, that they were highly secretive, that even people that were interviewed for jobs with them had to sign non-disclosure agreements even before they were interviewed with this company. And apparently the problem they were having then is that they couldn't get their vaccines to work because if they had too few nanolipid particles to deliver the mRNA, the vaccine wouldn't work. And if it was too high and they kept shooting too high, it ended up being toxic to the people that received it. There's no indication that this problem was ever solved by the time it was rolled out. And essentially in that article from 2016 and a subsequent one from the same outlet, Stat News, which is as mainstream as it gets in the U.S. in terms of healthcare in 2018, they basically said Moderna needs some sort of saving grace to rescue the company. Because at the time it was the most highly valued like private biotech company in the United States, but had no products. On the market, just a lot of products in their pipeline, and needed some way to get their products, to the public. So I think that's pretty significant.
Was this significant investment by DARPA, was this in 2013 or 17?
It was 2013.
2013, okay.
Yeah, and same with Pfizer. They also invested in Pfizer's mRNA technology, which are the mRNA vaccines being used right now. They were both developed with money. Okay. And of course, considerable influence from DARPA. And the person that actually made those investments or green-lighted them at DARPA. She actually left in 2012. The investments weren't formally made until 2013 as Regina Dugan, who later left DARPA to basically create a DARPA equivalent for Google, and then later for Facebook as well. And she's the one that has now teamed up with the Wellcome Trust to create this DARPA equivalent for the Wellcome Trust. That's a global DARPA, they say, a global health DARPA. It's very insidious.
What's the name of that woman again?
Regina, it's a hard G, but it's spelled like Regina, Dugan, D-U-G-A-N.
Okay. What I didn't understand is there really, was that after the anthrax attacks that they developed a vaccine?
No, they had it before. Okay. They had it before and it didn't work and it was like killing people basically. And all these people in the US military were refusing to take it and it was getting to the point where they were tying people physically down and forcibly injecting them.
Whoa.
In the US military. Yeah. And it was a huge scandal.
How did this come out?
Well, Meryl Nass, who's a doctor and was very involved in the lawsuit. Yeah. She's the person to talk to you about all of that because she was involved in the lawsuit that was brought by military veterans against the Pentagon involving all of this. But it was basically mandated as made a mandatory vaccine policy in the late 90s, I believe 1998. Or so, and it, right when BioPort was made, and it was basically their only product and their only way to make money, even though it didn't work. And in September 2001, the Pentagon was going to release a report about how to continue the anthrax vaccine policy without this company and their toxic anthrax vaccine. And of course, you have 9/11 happen. So the report doesn't come out. And then the anthrax attacks happen. And all of a sudden, the concern over the issues of the anthrax vaccine are replaced with wide calls to use it not just in the military now, but in first responders, police, teachers even.
When did the accidents happen? I mean, they don't seem to be really accidents, but when were people killed? Before or after 9/11?
So it was announced the first case in early October 2001, but right after 9/11, people intimately tied to the Bush administration and the neocons were talking constantly about how Al-Qaeda in Iraq were going to attack Americans with anthrax and various things. And I think the New York Times in that same period did 27 articles in like a couple weeks about anthrax and stuff like that. And one of the main articles, the main authors of those articles was Judith Miller, who later received a fake anthrax letter during the attacks. And she, along with a lot of top officials in the U.S., had been involved in a simulation of what would be the anthrax attacks, essentially called Dark Winter, that took place in June 2001. And a lot of people, the same people that actually produced the Dark Winter simulation and then later personally briefed Dick Cheney himself about it, are the same people that oversaw and moderated Event 201 last year before the coronavirus situation.
I have to hold it for one second.
Okay, but this is not Johnson & Johnson, but this is Emerging Biosolutions.
Who manufactures the Johnson & Johnson vaccine now.
Okay. So Wolfgang asks again about the lipid nanoparticles. He is afraid, this is just an hypothesis, but still, he's afraid that maybe they're experimenting with the amounts of lipid nanoparticles. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about this?
Or like the shedding.
Because this may have something to do with what is now known as shedding.
It's possible. So I don't know exactly what they're doing with the current vaccines in that sense. But what Moderna said specifically, well, before years, at least 2 years before COVID-19, is that this was a problem they had they could not solve. Mm-hmm. Now that it's being widely used in emergency use authorization type of situation, which is not the same as being fully licensed, obviously, mm-hmm. They have a lot more leeway potentially to do so. And it honestly would not surprise me because they were pretty desperate as a company to get around that issue. And really the only way to get around it, if you can't fix it and having too high a dosage of nanolipid particles was resulting in toxicity, you obviously have to, if you want to get around that quickly, you need some sort of crisis or some other type of situation where they can obfuscate the nature of that issue. And it's very unfortunate that, little has been done about that obvious issue, but an admitted issue they were having with these vaccines before they were widely used on the public.
Let's ask about so what do you think with these vaccines, since we know it's, at least we've come to that conclusion, that we're not really dealing with a medical problem in the sense of that we have like a full-blown epidemic or something like that. You know, there must be other... what's behind? What's the agenda behind it? You see it mainly like as a financial thing, or
that eugenics? The military is heavily connected with all of the so-called vaccines. Is there a conclusion that we can draw from this?
Yeah, I would argue so. So, what I mentioned in the beginning about sort of the Silicon Valley push to remake healthcare, a key part of that is what they call precision medicine. And of course, if you look at what precision medicine is, they describe it as medications and vaccines and gene therapies targeted to the individual, i.e. targeted to an individual's own genome. So this is why we're seeing this increase through the also under the guise of COVID-19 testing, this huge effort to amass genetic data of people across the world. Of course, a lot of this is actually being held by the same Silicon Valley companies. So in the case of the Western US, a lot of COVID-19 testing has been done by Verily, which is a Google subsidiary, which is at the same time is trying to make their AI healthcare based on this genetic data and what have you. A lot of those same technologies for precision medicine also come from the U.S. military or involve sort of predictive diagnoses where they say, based on an AI algorithm, you are likely to have this disease, whether it's COVID or cancer or anything else, before you actually show symptoms of it. Just take their word for it. And that's being co-developed right now by the Google in a part of the military called the Defense Innovation Unit. And there's lots of other examples of this going on. So I would argue that the wide-ranging use of these mRNA vaccines and treating them as regular vaccines instead of when they were previously in years past described by even US media as gene therapy is a way to normalize the same type of Silicon Valley-based precision medicine that they want to be the new normal, I guess you could say, in healthcare around the world.
It is so funny that we can observe in the legislation, we can see in 2009 in summer, in July, the German Bundestag passed a law changing the pharmaceutical law, Arzneimittelgesetz. Mm-hmm. And they just changed the definition of vaccine. Mm-hmm. And they inserted there that giving nucleic acids may be called genetic therapy, but also maybe named vaccine. And so that they could just 2009 in summer, it was just before the German election. Mm-hmm. It was in the swine flu time. Uh-huh. They just changed it. So they opened the possibility to cause this gene therapy, this genetical modification of human beings, call it vaccines if it is aimed to fight infections.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's essentially the same thing, but this is part of a broader move to normalize this type of medicine to the broader public and so sort of use vocabulary that has previously been associated with more traditional medical interventions, but instead apply it to things that are not traditional at all.
We are now observing the coming out of a very long-running strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, this gene editing push within medicine. If you look back to someone like Julian Huxley, the first director general of UNESCO and former president of the British Eugenics Society, which still exists today.
Brother of Aldous Huxley. Institute.
Yes. Well, the British Eugenics Society still exists, by the way. It's called the Galton Institute. They didn't rename until 1989. Adrian Hill of the AstraZeneca vaccine spoke at their 100-year anniversary, celebrating 100 years of basically eugenics. And the Wellcome Trust hosts their archive, which they think is of great use to medicine in general. But actually, going back to Julian Huxley in 1946, you know, he said we should make the unthinkable thinkable again. And not in about roughly 10 years later, he coined the term transhumanism and said that gene editing as a eugenic science needed to be applied along with these new sort of efforts to merge humans with machines as a way to create a new human being or human being 2.0 or whatever. And that's when he coined the term transhumanist. So, you know, that's going back to the 1957. It's definitely an old agenda, to say the least.
I'm sorry, 46, right?
Well, he said one of those statements he made in 46 about regarding eugenics, we have to make the unthinkable thinkable again,
right?
And then lays out a roadmap for how to do that roughly 10 years later in a book that I believe is titled New Bottles for New Wine, something like that.
Yeah.
That's about this new eugenics push. And then you have someone at the Galton Institute, the Eugenics Society. More recently, one of their board members, David Galton, publishing a book that was actually positively reviewed in the UK press about eugenics in the 21st century, and front and center are these gene editing, you know, medicines, quote unquote medicines.
Let me clarify this. 1946, that's when he gave this speech. That's when he said we have to make the unthinkable thinkable again.
Well, eugenics. I can't remember if it was a speech or if it was written, but
I think it was a speech, or maybe it was written. We don't know. But wasn't that in connection with the founding of UNESCO?
UNESCO, it was.
And was he one of the, was he a director or something of UNESCO?
The founding director general of UNESCO. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, but with this this push for the precision medicine, is this like a mere money making scheme, you know, because then you can sell this targeted or whatever tailored medicine, and it's maybe not working on you. But it seems to, I mean, for me, you know, since we're also running into like a big economic problem, I don't see that so many people could even pay a lot of money for this tailored medicine. So there might be some additional motive behind this.
Control.
Yeah, I think it's about control and ultimately the end of the day about eugenics. I think they want people to take this, employ this type of medicine so much that I fully expect the Biden administration, which the Obama administration in the U.S. funded a lot of this precision medicine initiatives considerably. Biden is creating a health DARPA that's going to be led by Eric Lander, who has ties to eugenicists, was funded by Jeffrey Epstein, among other people. To lead this thing. And it's all about precision medicine, but I fully expect that there's this push for socialized medicine, Medicare for all in the US, and that they'll basically make it so, basically allow that to take place, but only if it's these precision gene edited medicines that they'll offer to people for free.
What role did Jeff Epstein play in all this? I know, I mean, we've heard, because this, even the mainstream media reported on this, that he wanted to create new people with his own DNA, something like that, I believe.
He wanted to seed the human race with his DNA, essentially. Yeah, he had a lot of ideas, but what's important is that, you know, now that he's gone, right, his the scientists that he funded are still very much around. One of them that's a key person to look at is someone like George Church, who is a Harvard geneticist, and he's been openly accused of promoting eugenicist ideas, even by the mainstream U.S. press.
And also again? George what?
George Church.
Okay.
He's also promoted basically unethical human experimentation by trying to resurrect Neanderthals by implanting them into a human woman, and all of this stuff. I mean, really bizarre stuff, but he's never been, he's actually pretty heavily promoted. But what's interesting about Epstein is that you have to look at something called the Edge Foundation, which was basically operating as a front for Epstein. Epstein was its only donor for from about 2001 to 2017, the vast majority of its money came from Epstein exclusively, and it was a way for Epstein to gain influence over people both in Silicon Valley who were big attendees and a lot of these geneticists type scientists at Harvard, MIT, and a lot of these top universities.
But Epstein wasn't, I mean, he wasn't the head of this.
He was an operative. Yeah, sure.
But someone else is using him to funnel their money through him, right?
But I think there's a couple different things there because he worked for more than one intelligence agency doing different things. But I think, honestly, his main handler at the end of the day is going to be this group of Zionist billionaires in the U.S. Called the Mega Group, which is basically the Leslie Wexner and the Bronfman family, both of whom have ties to organized crime going back to like the 20s and the 30s. Who have a considerable amount of influence over both U.S. and Israeli politics. But in terms of like, you know, his involvement in this, I mean, he was very involved in science and the tech angles of things that we're seeing happen right now, but he definitely wasn't alone in that and definitely is not the orchestrator of that. Just, you know, a cog in the machine, as it were. People like Ghislaine Maxwell's sister, Isabel Maxwell, a World Economic Forum technology pioneer with ties to Israeli intelligence, also intimately involved in aspects of that. And of course, an Epstein associate who's ties they claim to be investigating now, but they're still covering up considerably, is to someone like Bill Gates, whose ties with Epstein actually go back most likely to the 1990s, based on considerable evidence that mainstream media refuses to pursue.
What is that evidence saying? What kind of connection was that?
So if you believe the mainstream media narrative, Bill Gates and Epstein didn't meet, they say, until 2011. However, there's a 2001 Evening Standard, it's a UK newspaper, article written by a reputable reporter that was never retracted, and of course written before Epstein was notorious for anything, that says that Epstein's main business partners were Leslie Wexner, Donald Trump, and Bill Gates. And then, of course, you have at least one Epstein survivor, Maria Farmer, who worked for Epstein between 1995 and 1996, hearing them discuss Bill Gates as if they were good friends. And she expected him, Gates, to come visit one of Epstein's properties at some point, though she didn't see him. But they obviously were discussing him. They knew each other. And beyond that, there's a documented relationship between Isabel Maxwell and her companies and Bill Gates specifically. That's reported in a 2001 Guardian article where Isabel Maxwell, who's very open about having inherited the espionage portfolio on behalf of Israel from her father, Robert Maxwell, sometimes called Israel's super spy. Basically in this Guardian article, this is the Guardian's way of describing it. She starts purring when she talks about Bill Gates and starts talking in a fake Southern belle, like a U.S. Southern accent, even though she normally speaks in a British accent. She's never done this in any other interview. It's just when she talks about Bill Gates. And she says that she personally persuaded him to invest money to maintain his tax-free status and her company ComTouch, which was basically a front for Israeli military intelligence at the time. It's the only way he could have done that to be tax-free was to use the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust, which is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's philanthropic investment vehicle to invest in that particular company. So, And of course, also Epstein had documented ties to Bill Gates' closest advisor, Nathan Myhrvold, who was also chief technology officer of Microsoft. Throughout the 1990s, Epstein traveled with him to the Microsoft Russia conference in 1998. Myhrvold flew on his plane several times. That's documented. He was seen taking underage women to Myhrvold's offices for reasons we don't quite know. So, and there's several other executives there as well. And of course, Epstein's science advisor in the 90s became the Gates Foundation's top science advisor by 2005, Melanie Walker. And so if we're to believe that, you know, Gates didn't know Epstein until 2011, why would he hire a woman to be a science advisor for his foundation whose, you know, only thing on her resume was being Jeffrey Epstein's science advisor? You'd have to know who Epstein was to want to hire her at your foundation, correct? So there's definitely a considerable cover up there. I would argue it because it's because it shows that potentially Microsoft as a company was compromised by the same intelligence linked network that Epstein operated in. And you know, a lot of other, you know, ties in terms of Gates Foundation science and investments, you know, may have had the influence of Epstein and Maxwell well before 2011.
Does it really? I mean, if I listen to this story and if I take a look at the names that you're mentioning, I mean, many of these people are obviously stark raving mad. What is going on? I mean, does the public, of course the public doesn't understand anything about this, but if they did know, if this came out, I mean, if this was verified, people would, their whole belief of the world would collapse.
Yeah, well, I think that's why some people are reticent to engage with this type of information. And this was an issue that happened before COVID with things that happened in other places around the world. An example I'm really familiar with is someone from the United States is September 11th, 2001, that, you know, there's still people even 20 years later that any sort of deviation from the official narrative, they just can't handle. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, one of the reasons the public isn't aware is also just because of the increasing consolidation of media outlets in the hands of the elite who can, you know, dominate to the greatest extent they possibly can, the flow of information, of course, to their benefit. And yes, a lot of people in these elite circles are totally crazy, but that's because, of course, that they have completely isolated themselves from any sort of interaction with regular people or the general public, and basically live in these bubbles where they have these obsessions like achieving immortality through you know, transhumanism and all these different technologies they're developing, among other things, and you know, have a total worldview that just would be so bizarre to most people in the general public if they were made aware. And that's why I think, you know, you don't really have a lot of people in the general public, for example, that tune in regularly to the Davos meetings of the World Economic Forum, because they discuss a lot of these things there that are really over the head of most people. Including, you know, one of their keynote speeches in 2020 was by an Israeli individual named Yuval Noah Harari, who talked about that soon there will be an age of digital dictators, that humans have now been reduced to hackable animals. Those are his terms, through the combination of this genetic engineering and advances in brain-machine interface and technology. And basically said that soon governments around the world will start mandating or introducing the ideas of wearables, wearable sensors, extornable wearables, which are now being promoted for healthcare. And that, you know, eventually these will develop into things that can read your thoughts and emotions. Amazon's wearable already claims to be able to detect your emotional state based on biometrics like your voice. Among other things, Facebook is developing one that it claims can read your nerve signals before you even move. Among other things, again, that was developed by Regina Dugan, who now works for Wealth and Leap and previously worked for Facebook. So he said once these things are widely used, the age of digital dictatorships will be irreversible. And he's telling this to the crowd of the World Economic Forum, the most elite people in the world, in January 2020, and imploring them to control the use of this technology and to use it first before the rats gain access to this themselves. And of course, you can speculate as to who the rats are supposed to be from these individuals' perspective. But it's quite a jarring speech. I did an analysis of
What's
it.
What's his name again?
This is the Harari.
Yuval Noah Harari, H-A-R-A-R-I.
Was ist der?
Der hat dieses Buch geschrieben.
Oh ja, also gut. Let me try.
I mean, this is how the elite view us now. Hackable animals, right?
Animals, yeah.
And this is right before COVID hit in March. You know, this was in January, talking about hackable animals. Time for you, the elite, to control the new hackable animals and lead them where you will type of scenario. It's quite jarring. So anyway, this is really over the head of the public, but I think even showing that video, even without commentary, though commentary does help, you know, is very illustrative of the elite's view.
Where do we find this?
I'll happily send it to you.
Absolutely.
I have also everything I talked about today, the Emergent BioSolutions anthrax stuff, the AstraZeneca vaccine, and the Welcome Leap, all of that I have extensive documentation on. So I'm happy to send that along.
Everything would be just cool with these people if they were in insane asylums, but they're not.
No.
Okay.
And can I ask you So it seems that all the politicians and other people in charge are playing along. Do you think they're all involved in this transhumanist agenda or believe in that? Or do you think there could be some sort of bribery also going on, maybe also connected to this whole Epstein kind of thing or like...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there is a lot of division within the ruling elite, but I think a lot of that division has to do with fighting over the spoils of who gets more power and control than other groups, based on what I've seen in terms of how prevalent the transhumanist thing is. It definitely is prevalent, but I'm not exactly confident enough to say that everyone in the elite believe it, but it is very common. And if you look at someone like Klaus Schwab, talking about what the fourth industrial revolution means and how COVID-19 is the catalyst for the great reset to move into the fourth industrial revolution. You know, he describes that as the merging of biological and our biological, digital and virtual identities, something to that effect, which is essentially, positing the merging of man and machine. You're having someone that leads the World Economic Forum saying that to that degree. It obviously is prevalent enough for the people that attend the World Economic Forum meetings and are involved in that to be like, yeah, that sounds cool to us. Let's go on with this push to create that kind of world. It obviously has to be prevalent to a significant degree for that many people to sign on to that.
Mm-hmm. Wolfgang is trying to tone this down a little because he says that back in, wann war das, als du gesagt hast?
Das war so, ja, dann war das 2005 ungefähr.
Back in 2005, yeah. When they came up with this new idea of, was war das?
Das waren die stem cell therapy with embryonic stem cells.
Yeah.
It was a big hype.
They had these new ideas of creating new spare parts for the human body. Mm-hmm. That was probably also had something to do with transhumanism. And he says, well, yeah. You know,
Welcome Leap is doing that right now.
Yeah.
Actually.
Well, he says that much of this is, of course, it cannot be realized because the human body just doesn't accept this. But it is an idea. It's an investment idea. And that's what he believes is in the foreground here. They're trying to lure people into these investment schemes, even if they don't work. I do believe, however, that you're right, that many of these people really believe in these theories, like Klaus Schwab is evidently stark raving mad, as I said.
Yeah, I think it's hubris.
It's hubris. Yeah, it's the feeling of omnipotence. We can do anything, but they can't. The rats are going to show them how it is when you get blown out of the water, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I think a really good indicator of that, though it's not related to the stem cell research angle, it's related more to AI, is that they definitely, in my opinion, the elite definitely thought that specifically by now, they would have artificial intelligence much more advanced than it has been. They're very desperate to trigger what they refer to as the singularity. It's very possible that they'll never be able to do that because essentially the singularity is making a conscious machine. And these are the most unconscious people in the world trying to replicate consciousness. It's a lot of arrogance, I think. And they're just very invested in the power of technology because they know the only way they can micromanage the lives of so many people around the world, having so few people exert that much control over that many people is through this technology. But unfortunately, for them, it's really not working. But I think they want to cast these technologies and these investments as technology that's inevitable. We have no power, that we should just sit back and there's nothing we can do to stop these agendas, when in that's reality, right. I don't think that's true at all. And unfortunately, there's some people in independent media that play into this, that sort of fall prey to that fear mongering. And I think it really needs to be resisted, because, you know, they put these things on the splash pages of their research organizations and stuff. It's a propaganda tool at the end of the day, to make us think that, you know, all of this stuff is inevitable.
We don't have a chance. Right.
Right. Well, right. And I think
choice,
that's,
and we do have a
exactly.
chance. We're the rats, you know. We can blow things out of the water.
Yeah, well, I think also it's important to point out that consent matters to a huge degree, whether it's the vaccines or any of these other technologies that they're trying to push through. And they want people to forget that, and they want people to be afraid, because fear throughout history has been their greatest tool. Yeah. Once people shed the fear, it's much harder for them to push through any of these agendas.
That's the point. Okay.
Life goes on within you and without you.
Yeah.
I have one question, or two questions rather, like for a finishing or final question. The cyber polygon thing, how does that play into maybe like the fear porn that we're exposed to? And plus, what do you think is, like, apart from sort of shining light on the whole thing, the whole agenda, would be your advice for, like, getting out of that whole House of Cards?
Okay. So I'm going to answer the second one first, because the first part is definitely a bit longer. Mm-hmm. So in addition to exercising your right to consent to things and not making a conscious decision to not mentally or emotionally engage with that fear, I really think the way out is counter economics, that people that oppose these agendas come together to produce what they need to survive independent of these systems, because this is ultimately successful because people are dependent on the governments and the corporations that are intimately involved with that. The most powerful protest at this point is going to be an economic protest. Governments around the world are just waiting for more violent protests or riots. They have lots of tools and plans to deal with those. For example, in the U.S., they're launching a war on domestic terror that is obviously going to target dissidents from the way it is written. And they openly say that's a multinational approach. It's very possible that much of the West, you know, could try and do something with that. And, you know, the more visible you are trying to go to the streets and stuff like that, that is the type of response that they're expecting, whereas a passive, nonviolent protest of economic resistance and counter economics and just becoming independent of the people trying to build these systems, I think, is the most effective way to really counter it. At this point, and I'm not necessarily telling people not to protest or anything like that, but people need to keep in mind the surveillance stuff that they've been setting up and things like that, and that they plan to, you know, take people that are more vocal in that sense, you know, to court or give them legal trouble or other things. And I think a broader counter-economics movement, in addition to, you know, a larger movement of people not consenting and just not engaging with the system, is something that they fear a lot more, that I think could be really powerful. As far as cyber polygon goes, so before this year's Davos, right, the World Economic Forum annual meeting, Klaus Schwab basically gave a very predictive, you can say, speech, saying that at some point this year, perhaps, you know, we may see it in the next couple of months or not, but it's already indications of it are already there and have been there. But he said this back in January, that COVID, the fear of COVID, would give way to fear about climate change. And of course, also the so-called cyber pandemic, which has been simulated in the cyber polygon exercise, which happened last year, last July. It's going to happen again on July 9th. Basically, cyber polygon, even though it is a simulation of this type of cyber pandemic, as they're calling it, you know, is basically a way of essentially faking a pandemic in the virtual world, I guess you could say, as a way to exert complete control over the virtual world, i.e. the internet, both through censorship and also linking internet access to digital biometric IDs as a way to eliminate anonymity in the internet, but also intimately involves the financial system as a way to prevent ways of having anonymous financial transactions, which is ultimately going to come down to a war on cash and a war on cryptocurrency. Okay. And we've already seen a lot of movements within that space. But if you look at CyberPolygon, the exercise itself, most of the partners are banks, including Deutsche Bank, which, of course, you all are familiar. It has been teetering on the brink of collapse for a long time, as have a lot of the other banks that are intimately involved with this effort. They are very desperate to introduce their own central bank digital currencies and basically reset the global financial system in such a way that they don't have to take any blame at all. And what better way to do that than to have the whole banking system, as CyberPolygon simulates, taken down by faceless hackers. And of course, you can attribute those hackers to being this dissident group or this state actor or whoever they want, really. And of course, the banks are absolved from whatever financial carnage ensues. And, you know, they've made it very explicit that this is basically what they plan to do through various different initiatives. The World Economic Forum and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace have teamed up on this. A group, an ISAC group that represents the biggest Wall Street banks in America, have done this as well. And these initiatives are all partnered with the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the U.S., the European Central Bank, the Bank of England. You know, they're all very much involved. Of course, Russia, Russia's Sberbank, which is often the main stakeholder, is Russia's government, is the main co-sponsor of the CyberPolygon exercises. They have already introduced their central bank backed digital currency, a Spurcoin, and are attempting to make basically that a monopoly for all, you know, market services within Russia, having it be based on their digital marketplace ecosystem and using specifically this digital currency. So this is something that these banks want to move to, and they need some sort of manufactured crisis to get widespread adoption of that. So I could go into more detail. I don't want to go too far in the interest of time, but I do have a lot of documentation about CyberPolygon as well and a couple of related articles that I'm happy to send along.
Yes, please. Thank you very much. We'll be in touch, and I'm sure we're going to have lots more to talk about.
Okay, sure. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Whitney. Take care.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You too. Bye-bye.